This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here with
Keith Phipps
and
Genevieve Kosky.
Tasha Robinson is out sick this week. Feel better soon, Tasha. This is really, honestly, this podcast in the winter is just kind of an audio record of the fact that everyone gets ill.
I'm the only one who hasn't been sick yet.
I know. And I've had so many wonderful contagious diseases. Here on the Next Picture Show, we believe that no film exists in a vacuum and that all culture is more interesting in context. So every other week, we get together to talk over a classic film and consider how it relates to a current movie. This week, we're looking at two documentaries that go behind the scenes of two Democratic campaigns and follow the incredible twists and turns in the lead up to Election Day. Genevieve, tell the nice people about this week's pairing.
This week, we're going to tell you a story about the rise and fall of Clintonism in America. D.A. Pennebaker and Chris Hegedus's 1993 documentary, The War Room, follows the presidential campaign of an exciting young upstart from Arkansas named William Jefferson Clinton as he tries to win the Democratic primary and unseat President George Herbert Walker Bush after 12 years of Republican rule. Josh Kriegman and Elise Steinberg's documentary Wiener from last year follows disgraced Congressman Anthony Wiener's failed comeback bid to run for mayor of New York City in 2013. In a way, Clinton's campaign paved the way for Wiener's. Just as Clinton was able to convince the public to look past his marital infidelities, Wiener was hoping his sexting scandal could be forgiven. The parallels are even stronger when you consider the fact that Wiener's wife, Huma Abedin, was one of Hillary Clinton's closest aides. But in Wiener's case, reality did not follow the same script.
No, it did not. In fact, the blast radius of Anthony Weiner's campaign was so immense that it wound up engulfing Hillary Clinton's presidential ambitions. In the final days of the 2016 election, when it looked like Clinton was cruising to victory over Donald Trump, FBI Director James Comey wrote a letter warning about the possibility of classified emails finding their way onto Weiner's laptop. She lost the election and blamed Comey, and Wiener the documentary took on a whole new meaning. But that's the end of our story. After the break, we'll start at the beginning. Back when we still believed in a place called hope.
Somebody who's been through a lot of tough elections, James Carville, is known as the Raging Cajun in the business.
So let me tell you what's at stake in this election. It's about George Bush and the whole sleazy little cabal of them. You're going to get tax breaks for the wealthy. You're going to get a guy that doesn't know what a grocery store scanner is.
I'm getting sick and tired. I am every single night hearing one of these carping little liberal Democrats jumping all over my you-know-what.
I'm George Stephanopoulos. I'm director of communications.
Bush was on the defensive. Another good night for Bill Clinton. Three debates. Three wins.
I guarantee you that if you do this, you'll never work in Democratic politics again.
If we cannot believe anything he has said about his past, how can we believe anything he's saying about the future?
Well, I think Mary Mallon's got a good career in fiction writing when this is over.
I'm lost. I don't know where I'm supposed to go next.
Turn Perot off. I don't want to look at it. How are you? Nice to see you.
Stay focused. Talk about things that matter to people.
We love Hillary's new patriotism thing.
It's the economy, stupid.
Speak from your heart tonight. I mean, that's all that matters.
Read my lips.
It's the most famous broken promise in the history of American politics.
Let them spin. We will win.
The Reagan Revolution was real. By the time the 1991 presidential election rolled around, Republicans had controlled the executive branch for three straight terms, two under Ronald Reagan, one under George H.W. Bush. For Democrats, the path to victory was unclear. When you're out of power for that long, it's hard to draw a winning electoral map, even when the incumbent has shown some vulnerabilities. And in Bill Clinton, you had a problematic candidate, to say the least. Though a former Arkansas governor, he was largely unknown and untested on the national stage. His reputation as a womanizer threatened to alienate both female voters and moral majority types, and there was no guarantee that a moderate Southern governor was the right answer for energizing the Democratic Party and controlling the executive branch for the first time since Jimmy Carter. The War Room would be a fascinating documentary even if the Clinton campaign stalled out in New Hampshire. But D.A. Pennebaker and Chris Hegedus wound up bearing witness to history and brought us inside an operation that would change the way campaigns were won. Unlike Wiener, we don't see much of the candidate himself. Instead, the War Room made stars out of two charismatic political professionals, lead strategist James Carville, a.k.a. the Ragin' Cajun, who brought a bare-knuckled approach to the job that effectively underlined the weaknesses of Clinton's primary opponents and President Bush, and handsome bastard George Stephanopoulos, who would go on to become the director of communications and a senior advisor to the Clinton White House before moving on to a career in journalism. The War Room is about Carville, Stephanopoulos, and others sincerely advocating for a candidate they felt would lead the country in a positive direction, but it's also about consultancy as a business. Years later, we wouldn't necessarily view James Carville and George Stephanopoulos as idealists, but more as opportunists with their own set of ambitions. With the War Room, Pennebaker and Hegedus didn't have special access to Clinton, and they deliberately avoid the news clips or title cards that might tell the larger story of the campaign as it unfolded. It's a great work of direct cinema, the fly-on-the-wall style mastered by directors like Frederick Wiseman, the Maisels brothers, and Pennebaker himself. By camping out behind the scenes, Pennebaker and Hegedus patiently collect the footage they need to tell a story in specific moments, from Carville passionately rallying the troops, to haggling sessions over 30-second ads, to potential attack lines over campaign materials manufactured overseas. And oh, those magnificent long-sleeved, multicolored collared shirts of Carville's. How have those not come back in style? We'll address that important question and many more after the break.
Somebody who's been through a lot of tough elections is James Carville, who's known as the Ragin' Cajun in the business. And we'd like him to say a couple of words to you.
We have a tough fight coming right down the stretch. It's going to come out that Roger Ailes is behind a lot of this stuff before the election that you've been seeing about Governor Clinton. Okay? Ailes. It is, and of course, Bush and Georgette Mossberg and everything else. Let me tell you what's at stake in this election. Every time that somebody comes along that's got some ideas, a Democrat comes along, the Republicans come up here and they ambush him. Remember Muskie? Okay? That is standard procedure. And here comes Clinton. He comes to New Hampshire. People here hurting. They want hope. They want somebody with vision. He gives it to them. So what do Republicans do? They get together with their wedge issues and they knock it off. If they succeed this time, it's going to be every time. You are never going to get a presidential candidate. Okay? You're never going to get somebody to come up here and run for president that served 11 years as governor, has got any kind of experience. Okay? And every time somebody comes up, they're going to do it. If we win this, then you have knocked this shit back forever.
Okay. So, did any of you see The War Room back in 1993 or just in the 90s in general? And what was your perspective on the film then and now?
I did not. In fact, I just saw it for the first time for this.
Really?
I know. I'm bad. But I do remember.
You're not bad.
I remember when it came out, though. I remember it'd be like, this is like nothing you've ever seen before. Mm-hmm. We didn't understand how politics worked until we saw this movie. It was sort of the reaction I remember from the reviews at the time.
Yeah, well, I was 10 when it came out, so no, I did not see it in 93, but I did see it in the 90s in high school, actually, in a civics class. In hindsight, I'm very confused as to why the teacher thought it would be a good thing for us to watch, especially considering the Monica Lewinsky scandal had happened like maybe a year or two earlier. So it seems like a very pointed thing to have a bunch of high schoolers watch this movie, but that's neither here nor there. But honestly, I don't really remember my impressions of it back then because I don't know, I was a junior in high school and didn't really care about this movie.
This is boring.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, why don't why aren't they doing anything? No, but rewatching it for this in the current political climate was an enlightening experience, to say the least. And also, like, being semi-familiar with James Carville and George Stephanopoulos, the figures they've become after this movie, that was also enlightening to kind of go back and see them in their nascent stages, so to speak. But yeah, I can't really say that my thoughts on the movie have evolved, because I don't remember what my initial thoughts on the movie were, but it was something to watch at this time.
Yeah, it really was. I guess I then would be the lone war room obsessive here. This election was the first presidential election that I voted in and that I participated in. I was in college, and I have a very strong memory of, this is the University of Georgia, and believe it or not, at the time, Georgia was very much in play and was a swing state, and it was a state that Bill Clinton won. And I remember Al Gore coming to campus and giving that speech.
The up-down speech?
Giving the up-down speech, and everybody was saying, I was out there too, saying up and down and up and down, and that whole bit about, you know, if you wake up in the morning and you're all cranky and it's raining and you look at the headline and it's four more years, that whole bit, like that canned stump speech, which is quite effective. I remember that very strongly. And I remember really going all the way with this thing. And not only did I see it, you know, a couple of times, I read James Carville and Mary Madeline's stupid book that they wrote together about being this wacky couple, that one of whom serves Republicans, the other one's a Democrat, but they get along, etc. And I think that was actually kind of a turning point in my thinking about politics.
I was going to ask you,
because when I saw The War Room, it was like, James Carville is amazing. This guy is a genius. He energizes his campaign. He loves his troops. You know, he's salty. He's like a really colorful figure. And I still believe, when you watch the film, I mean, that impression comes across strongly. But then when I read that book, it was like, okay, the reason why this relationship works is because they're political professionals.
They're both mercenaries.
Right, exactly. They're mercenaries. And if you go even further than that and see a documentary called Our Brand is Crisis, which is when Carville and his consultancy business got involved in an election that was with much more unsavory results than Bill Clinton beating George H.W. Bush, then you think, okay, this is how it really is. This isn't necessarily an idealist, or maybe, I mean, I guess with The War Room, it's a complicated situation where it's somebody who is, you look at James Carville and maybe you get a little bit of both. You know, I mean, I think he does sincerely believe in this candidate and how the country is going to change potentially under Bill Clinton, but there is that mercenary aspect that I don't know if it comes through in the film itself, but I think outside of the film and over the years, it's unavoidable. Really.
See, that's interesting to me, because, like, can you point to a place in The War Room where you see that sincere belief in the policies that Clinton stands for? Because when I viewed it, like, I saw Carville as kind of pure mercenary.
Really?
Yeah. Like,
you didn't think that speech that he gives about how there's nothing more precious that a person can give than their labor, and he starts crying.
Well, okay,
and he's talking because of the things that you've done, people are going to get better health care, people are going to get yada, yada, yada. And I thought, like, that's a very inspiring speech. And I think if you're in that room and you've been, which, again, I think this film is so evocative, and you can practically smell, you know, the stale pizza in that room. Mm-hmm. You know, I think you can see why these people have volunteers and campaign professionals have given so much of their energy to this guy.
Sure. I mean, that closing speech is fair point.
Sure. Okay,
yeah, but I did gloss
over
that.
I'm curious about the other side.
Yes, like, up until that point, I see him as a politics as competition figure, and like the way he digs down into the minutiae of the campaign feels less about hammering out the specific positions on this policy than hammering out the optics. And like, for coming from him, I really see only concern with how things look, and that's his job. That's what a campaign strategist does. And I didn't see anything beyond that until that final speech, which I guess for me was kind of colored by everything that came before as almost a performance, you know, for his troops that did do a lot of work. And for me, it seems like Carville is more in it for the experience of managing a winning campaign. Like, he wants to win, and he appreciates all the people on the staff who helped him win. And I feel that what he's saying about, you know, people getting health care and all that is just kind of an extension of the line he's been towing for the entire movie. Wow. You know, the points that he has just grown accustomed to making as part of this.
Right. So it's a different kind of messaging. He's got the messaging that he's doing for the public that he's trying to hone and to get his candidate elected. And you think that he even in that moment he is still messaging, but he's tailoring that message to his people who might have a different motive for supporting. That's an interesting point.
What about you, Keith? What's your take on Carville?
I think he's a consummate professional, and it seems like I want to think in this case, or he's not insincere. I think he does believe in these causes. I can also see him as someone who, if the Clinton campaign had sputtered out and Tsongas had taken off, he could easily have transferred his skills over there and be saying drawing on the same skills to elect him. You know, much like your Kellyanne Conway would switch from Cruz to Trump or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much there to be blamed really for that. I mean,
it's good to stay employed, you know.
Right. I mean, going from one, you know, particularly if you're a Democratic operative, you're going to go from one Democrat to the other. And I think there's been a consistency throughout Carville's career of embracing a certain brand of kind of a center left candidate. I don't think he's the type that you're going to see on a Bernie Sanders campaign, for example. Yeah. That's not really where his beliefs are. So I think those beliefs are present. But he's a slippery character, and I mean, he definitely gives this film its center of gravity. I mean, he is the person that you're really looking at. You know,
and the charge of any scene. I mean, the approach they take can be. You know, it is very much fly on the wall. So you better hope the fly does something interesting.
Yeah, and I think there's fascinating things too about. Well, I think we can just get into the filmmaking itself, but the sorts of things that get focused on, the details about campaign decisions that are made. There's a pretty famous scene, well, a couple of pretty big scenes, but one where they're just going over this ad over the phone.
No, right? Sir.
No, sir.
No, sir. No, sir. Or
That is so great. Oh, God, if one of us could do just that great Cajun accent, maybe Tasha would have been good for it if she were sick, but it's like, no, sir. No, sir. but just it being able to think, how are we going to take in this 30-second ad? How are we just going to be able to maximize that impact? And also, you know, the demands that are being made that are just impossible on the person who's having to cut this commercial together.
That like, disembodied voice on the other line of the phone. It's just like you can, I can like, it's so much richer, like having to picture what is going across her face as she is like trying to like maintain her composure on this
phone
call.
That adds time. We need to lose things, not add things.
Man, here's a way to save maybe a half a second or a second.
Yeah.
Under the second announcer, change a sentence to, now he wants you to believe what he says about Bill Clinton.
Actually, what I changed it to is now he's asking you to believe his attacks against Bill Clinton.
Fine, either way. That's
the other thing we could do, Mandy?
Yeah.
Maybe we could say, where we say no, Mr. President, this time I'm going to read the facts.
Yeah.
Maybe we just say no, this time I'm going to read the facts.
Better.
Yeah.
No, sir. Maybe that's a Southern thing, but no, sir. No, no, sir.
Well, it's
no,
nice
sir.
To say, Mr. President.
But I just think it's very important.
Sir.
I think it's very important we get at the end, we get that read my lips. I know that will drive them, the voters, that just, that's the most famous broken promise in the history of American politics.
I'm just telling you that kind of the way it's set up to be factual and, you know, big fact.
Well, what visual were you thinking of with the fact?
Well, I think just the way,
you know, the whack of a fact sign.
And then, okay, let's do that, but let's just get this spot produced.
Hey, I'm sitting in the studio. I'm doing it.
And then just the bit of just trying to figure out what could possibly be scandalous about George H.W. Bush. I mean, this is not George H.W. Bush is not a target-rich environment like a Donald Trump.
Yeah.
He's a pretty boring guy.
It's so, like the best they could come up with is that he's a politician.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like that's
he's a politician, and he makes campaign materials in Brazil.
Yeah.
Like, can you imagine getting upset about that?
Trying to figure out
how to make that upsetting.
Yeah, that scene is hilarious, and it, probably one of the most memorable Carville moments for me, just like watching his excitement over something that he perceives as like a potential nail in the coffin scandal that is really nothing. Like, yeah. and like most of the people around him seem to be like, okay, dude, you know.
You remember the great Brazil t-shirt manufacturing scandal, or banner manufacturing scandal of 92, right? I mean, it was rough.
Yeah. Oh my God.
And then meanwhile, he's managing this candidate that is just rife with scandal, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah.
It is remarkable. You know, obviously we've known the outcome going into this movie, but it is remarkable that they win. You know, it is an underdog story, and it is kind of strange in the end that I think Perot coming along probably helped, but the Clinton won.
But less so when you consider the present. I mean, less so when you consider, you know, that we just elected a sex criminal to the presidency. I mean, there's an awful lot of forgiveness of these sorts of things. I mean, I guess we'll get into
desire
this.
For change after having the same thing for a long time.
What's this?
Desire for change after having the same thing.
Well,
for
yeah,
a
exactly,
long time
exactly.
Is very strong.
Change is strong. I mean, I think it's hard to, you know, I mean, 12 years is a very long time, and I don't think there was a sense that Bush was doing anything particularly exciting or mm-hmm. special in his time in office. But I think we can get into that a little bit more with Wiener, too, into what sort of scandals stick and what sort of scandals don't, and what is important in public life and what in private life, and the way those two things kind of combine. But I wanted to get into the style of this film. You know, The War Room was shot in 16mm, you know, unlike today where you would have hundreds of hours of digital video to go through. There had to have been choices that were made on the part of Pennebaker and Hedges as to when to keep the camera going and when not to. I was just curious what you think of the style of the film.
Well, I mean, I think the kind of the strategy for, you know, working around the restrictions of 16mm are like kind of right there in the title, like The War Room. Like most of their filming is confined to actual like campaign headquarters. There's a lot during actual meetings. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's just like kind of strategic planning of being there when people are going to be saying things aloud and giving voice to opinions and ideas that they may not under kind of more out in the world circumstances, you know, like other documentaries may take the talking head approach to get that kind of information across. But by, you know, using these staff meetings as kind of a organizing principle for the film, you're able to kind of get a lot of basic information across that way. Kind of the the outcome of that is that it is not a particularly exciting film to look at in terms of visually stimulating. Like it's a very just kind of bland.
And it suffers from the sort of the tan and gray office aesthetic of the early 90s too.
Yeah. Which, I mean, it's not a mark against it. You know, like not every film has to be bursting with color and chiaroscuro, but it's part of the visual quality of this movie that it has this very kind of sedate palette, excluding, of course, Carville's shirts.
Yeah, right. They give you that color pop that you need. One of the things I think is so clever about the film, I mean, and you're right, I think there was a lot of strategy in terms of what is the perspective, you know, what's important, when do we roll the cameras? I think there was a lot of pretty important planning as far as that is concerned. And I think that we can also think of The War Room as, you know, a supplement to the election that we already know. You know, mm-hmm. If you're watching this film in 1993, You certainly know about that Bill Clinton won the primary and won the presidency, and there's some information that you can kind of skip. But I also think the film is super clever at getting across information in a visual way without having to use titles. I mean, one of my favorite moments in the film is when Bill Clinton wins the New York primary. The way that is conveyed is a shot of Times Square, and you see, you know, that typical shot of Times Square with all the billboards going vertical, and then off to the side of the screen you can see just a scroll saying Bill Clinton wins New York primary. I thought like that is a great shot and a really interesting way to get that information across. You know, it's unconventional, so there was just such a subtle artistry to that.
Yeah, I did feel like, because I am a few years removed from it, I felt a little adrift at times in terms of where we were at the course mm-hmm. of the campaign. If I just you know, lived through the 92 election, I feel less. But I think what you lose and that you gain, and overall, I really like the Pennemaker Hedgerus style. I like the sort of hang out and watch approach. I think you get things on camera you would not get any other way, and I wouldn't necessarily trade that. But like I toward the end of the film, I was like, oh wait, we're at election night.
Yeah,
you know, it just kind of crept up on me.
Yeah, I kind of had the same thought listening to you talk, Scott, because obviously that campaign was a pivotal moment for you as kind of a political junkie and a film person, someone who does not have very strong memories of that campaign because, again, I was like nine or 10. It was a little difficult to keep the thread of like when Perot got in the race and then he got out and then he got back in. And but that also adds an element of not surprise exactly, but discovery. Like, I had no idea that the Jennifer Flowers thing happened that early in the campaign. Like, mm-hmm. you know, like, I mean, it in my mind, it's just kind of like melded into the cloud of sex scandals surrounding Bill Clinton in the cultural imagination. And I didn't really remember any of the details of that. So when that happened so early, I was like, whoa, like it's kind of amazing to realize that he overcame something that happened that early on.
And that would come back later during one of his wife's presidential debates.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, yeah.
Oh my God. I've already blocked that out.
Yeah, that was a low point. A low point among low points. Point.
Oh, come on. You can't call that a low point. There's so many low points.
Yeah, but that sort of convention of accusers and the press conference he gave backstage, oh, that was bad.
Okay, so this is something I want to get into because, like, we've all kind of, like, made noises both on mic and off about how, like, this is a kind of a difficult watch now. And, like, do you guys – I mean, obviously – mudslinging existed before this campaign and this movie, but do you guys see – this movie is like a starting point or a seed for where we are now or the campaign that we just came out of?
The only real seed I see is that it was the birth of the Democratic machine. The Democrats were in legitimate disarray at that point in history. And this campaign showed that the Democrats could be winners and that they had a people. They had your Carvilles and Stephanopoulos. They also have Stan Greenberg, who's a famous pollster, shows up in the movie. There are political professionals who surface in this movie, maybe sometimes briefly and some at the center, who figured out how to make winners out of Democrats, figured out how to campaign against Republicans, which maybe involved a little bit, you know, a little bit more of a muscular campaign, if you want to put it in a euphemistic way.
Campaigns have always been ugly, but I do think there's a direct line between the way the Clinton scandals played out in the tabloids and the election of Donald Trump. I mean, I think, you know, and I don't think that the Lewinsky scandal just heightened that. I don't think that did anyone any favors. I think I'm going to sound like an old fuddy-duddy here, but I think it opened up what was acceptable to talk about when we talk about politics, and in a way that has been detrimental to the whole election process.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just kind of thinking of the kind of the salivating over scandal that you see in in this movie from both campaigns. But going back to what you were saying, Scott, about this kind of being the birth of the political machine, like depending on your viewpoint, and I think it's pretty clear what all of our viewpoint is on the current election, like that machine failed this time out.
It did.
And, you know, it's really, I think, easy to view this movie as kind of an insight into how the Democratic Party like got on track, but maybe a track that ended up going back off track.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I don't know. Like,
some of that has to do with the Clintons, with the inherent, like the charisma and strong ideas, but also the flaws and the way they turn people off as much as they excite people. It's all kind of there.
Here's the thing with Clintonism that I think ends up being a problem is this idea, I guess, of triangulation, right? Of trying to figure out what the formula is going to be and where you have to be positioned between left and right in order to win, like in order to find that winning coalition. And the idea with Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, what their campaigns had in common was like, we are going to try to seize that vote in the middle and not, and if that means either taking the base for granted or whatever, then that they're going to do that. And I think it was a little bit of a thing where the Democrats were so much in the wilderness when Bill Clinton was elected that I think people were excited. I mean, I certainly remember being a college student and being very excited about Bill Clinton's candidacy in a way that I don't think college students of today were terribly excited about Hillary Clinton's candidacy.
I remember thinking, buying into this idea that they could just get a Democrat in the White House, everything would be fine. You know, everything would be so much better. You know, and that was not that quickly became apparent that it was not going to be the case.
Well, I mean, you know, it was. I mean, it was better, but it wasn't. Well, yeah. It wasn't perfect. But I think that formula, it's not a one size fits all thing. You know, you can't really run one campaign and have one strategy and expect the strategy that paid off in 1992 to pay off in 2016.
Right. Well, and politics is reactive. It's responding to what has happened in the recent past, and what has happened in the recent past is always changing. So, you know, a strategy from 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago, is not going to necessarily play the same way in the current climate that has been affected by that strategy from those many years ago.
And I think there's a sense with the Clintons too of a lack of core beliefs. I mean, there's a malleability to their thinking, which is politically helpful in that they can evolve and again triangulate to whatever the current political thinking is and adjust to that. But I think it lacks that of just what do you stand, you know, the question of what do you stand for, what are your values. Maybe that doesn't come across quite as clearly.
Well,
but
I think people were a little wearier of it 24 years later, 24 years after first encountering it, during this last election.
Yeah.
You know, I think the Clintons were relatively new, and now I don't want to relitigate this last election, I guess, but at the same time, it's like, you know, there is an old story at this point, and I think there was sort of a reluctance to go back to that.
So what we're saying is Bernie would have won.
No, well,
I know. No. You got to say that.
I'm trying to think O'Malley would have won.
I don't know about that. So let's getting back to the war room itself, everyone. Instead of just drifting off into the sad death of Clintonism, which we will get to in our next segment. What other impressions do you have of the film? I mean, for one, I mean, this is a story of two consultants, but we haven't talked really much at all about George Stephanopoulos, a handsome bastard, George Stephanopoulos, who was really a breakout star from this movie. But, you know, when you watch it now, it's like, well, he's much more taciturn.
I think he embodies presence. The youthful spirit of the New Democratic Party at the time, too. I think he was sort of he's older, but a sort of Gen X adjacent political operative.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, he spends a lot of the movie in Carville's shadow, I think, but he's clearly a very integral part of that campaign and the movie. I guess I don't want to say he's Carville's straight man, because that's like not the dynamic they have, but they do form a sort of weird yin-yang of energy and idealism, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, and he does have, I think, another one of my favorite moments of the film does have him when his assistant is just really, really flirting with him. Do you remember this scene when they've just won, it's election night, and she's asking him how he feels? Do you remember this
at
all?
Oh, yeah. I didn't read that as flirting.
You did not? But, oh, my gosh.
But it was, I don't know. I read it as playing to the cameras, but I mean, it could certainly have been flirting.
Yeah, I got a little blushy watching that scene. So I just find that scene to be fascinating. I even went and kind of looked into the woman who was involved in that scene, and she wrote a book about being an assistant. You know, it was like
a whole thing.
Yeah, it's a whole thing. But so that's
if you were the type to write fan fiction, you would write fan fiction about those two.
You really would. It was like, it's hot stuff. I'm surprised that you all did not. Because I was thinking, like, yeah, okay, this is George Stephanopoulos. This is all, this whole thing is paying off for him. Because, yeah, he was very, that was a little uncomfortable.
We don't know what's in the outtakes.
Yeah, too hot for TV.
What?
How do you feel?
Still not, you know, it's getting close. I mean, I was pretty shook up talking to him.
What did he say?
They were giddy. It's like it didn't, I mean, they're just like.
Are you like happy, or are you scared, or are you nothing, or do you want to just like cry, or what?
The crying was before. Maybe it'll be later, too. No, it's just like, floating.
So there are a lot of, you know, famous clips in the film. I mean, what were some of the more, you know, indelible moments for you?
Well, I have actually a Stephanopoulos scene that I was going to kind of bring up in talking about him. So, hey, segue. But that scene, like, toward the end where he gets a phone call about something that someone has, and he is trying to talk that person out of it. And it's, I don't know if I missed it or if it's like purposefully unclear of like what, who he's talking. Yeah. But just the maneuvering and the slickness, but also like sort of like panicked bumblingness, kind of combining into trying to not seem desperate and desperately talking this person out of going forward with whatever it is that are threatening to go forward
with. It sounds like just, I think you just imagine it being another tabloid scandal for Clinton. But oh my gosh, you're right. That scene is incredible. Just like, you know, you can do this, but here's what's going to happen to you. Your career is going to be ruined.
Yep.
Yeah, that is...
Like, that's the moment where I get, like, a Carvel-esque energy out of him.
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, this guy is... He's packing heat, you know? Yeah. You know?
Yeah, and you can imagine him having those kinds of conversations behind closed doors that we mm-hmm. did, that we weren't witness to, that were pretty critical to keeping the heat off of the candidate.
Yeah, mine's kind of the same scene, but for a different reason, because what they're talking about there is this rumor that Clinton has an illegitimate child.
Oh, that's right.
A black illegitimate child, which came up in this last election, too. The same, it's like the way these, nothing ever disappears, you know, and like these scandals, true or false, will just stick to people forever, and perception becomes reality. And that's, I think Carville understands that. I think everyone understands that on the campaign, too, and it's as true now as it was then.
You know what? Here's a point I've been wanting to make. You know, watching this and then of course experience the 2016 election, is I feel like all of us are just being held captive by this fight between hippies and reactionaries in the baby boomer generation, and they are holding the country hostage, and we're having to deal with that nonsense. And Donald Trump, to me, was going to be just the last spasm of this conflict. It's the last ugly death spasm of reactionary baby boomers, and now he's president and could reshape the whole country. But it's so frustrating as a member of a younger generation, and Genevieve, a much younger generation.
Much younger.
So much younger.
Oh my gosh. To have to be held hostage by this fight that is kind of holding the whole country back. So that's an aside, but I felt like I had to make it. But when you're talking about indelible moments, the one for me is on election night when the results are coming in and they're getting all this in paper, and there's a very famous moment where pollster named Mickey Cantor is getting very excited about all the numbers that are coming in. And, you know, it's just one of those great candid behind the scenes sort of salty moments where he says, "Look at Indiana. Those people are blank," you know, and there's been some controversy, and this came up, you know, this come up as late. I'm doing an internet search on it now, and this came up as late as, you know, May 2008, where they're trying to just, you know, parse that line. Is that what he actually said, or was he saying people are blanking in the White House? Like are the White House people have got to be upset about this? It's just the magic of documentary to kind of be there when people don't realize the camera's around, where the mic is hot, and you just get this great, you know, very colorful moment on the record.
Yeah, per Pennebaker, it is those people must be blanking in the White House, mm-hmm. Which makes a lot more sense in context.
Maybe
just insulting an entire state.
Yeah, it's possible. I think there was no raw expectation. Raw there was no expectation that they were going to win Indiana or do well in Indiana, as the as I call Indiana the home of the "Hell is Real" billboard. but it's a fun state.
And our vice president.
Oh yeah, God. I there's no way people have sex in that state. that's just my. I don't know how they.
Hello to all of our Indian listeners.
I don't know how they reproduce, but it's not that way. I'm just saying. He calls his wife mother. Did you know that Mike Pence calls his wife mother?
Okay, we're getting way off track.
But
apologies to Indiana. I know lovely people in Indiana.
That's true. I had a very nice time in Indiana. Not having sex in it, but I did have a nice time. I visited there. I visited there, and it seemed like a very...
They have a wonderful children's museum.
They do.
They have a very nice art museum in Indianapolis.
Yeah. Okay.
If you like race cars, I understand there's a race car facility there.
Yeah. So it takes the urges down, it tamps down the urges going to the race car.
So, all right, let's steer Scott away from this.
Okay. Any other thoughts on the war room?
I like that the waiter offers him Busch beer at the very end.
That's
just like, I spent a lot of time thinking like, okay, so is the bar like running a special on Busch beer because it's the election, or is it just a coincidence? Does this waiter know who he's talking to? Like, I have so many questions about that moment when the waiter offered James Carville a Busch beer on election night.
I just think it was just something that just happened, and he had that. He had that response. Got to have a Budweiser. I think Budweiser is what he ended up getting instead. But,
yep, most American of beers.
That's right. Well, the end of the campaign, that's as good a place to leave it as any. We'll be right back with some listener feedback on our last episode. Due to the Sundance Film Festival and various Chicago weather-related illnesses, it's been a few weeks since our last podcast on Jim Jarmusch's Stranger Than Paradise and Patterson. But we do want to alert you to an incredible email we received from one of our Hungarian listeners, Andras, who answered Tasha's request for a translation to Aunt Lottie's Hungarian rants. The email is too long to read here, but if you're a fan of Stranger Than Paradise and always wanted to know what Aunt Lottie was saying, we've posted it to our Facebook page.
It's great. I highly recommend going to check it out.
Thank you, Andras. We could not have been more delighted to receive this.
And sorry if we mispronounced your name.
Oh, yeah. That's right. The final indignity. You've done all this work for us, and we mangle your name. As for other feedback, Keith, why don't you get us started?
Sure. Here's a simple question for the group from listener Peter. Peter asks, can you actually watch a film and have fun without trying to dissect it?
The classic question.
Oh, Peter. You know what? I think Peter's being kind of trolly here, but I'm going to read this in such a way that it sounds helpful. I have a question. Can you actually watch a film and have fun without trying to dissect it, being, you know, accomplished professionals who are very good at your job at analyzing films? Put a little spin on there for you.
Well, I think trying to dissect a film is fun, which may be why I do what I do.
I object to the word
living.
Dissect, which is a dead thing. You know, you're cutting up a dead thing on a table, which is not what we are doing.
Yeah. It's alive, like the wine in Sideways, right?
It's more of a vivisection. Yeah.
Well, I would say this. This is the way I put it, is that I have a strong emotional reaction or intellectual reaction or whatever to a movie, and then criticism is about trying to account for that reaction. And I would also say that the amount of experience that I've had watching films has only made me more acutely attuned to the things that films do well. And so if a film does hit a certain grace note, like, you know, if D.A. Pennebaker puts a camera in the middle of Times Square to give us a subtle way of showing how Bill Clinton won the New York primary, then that's really exciting and is something I react to, and I have fun. So much fun. Key word here, I have fun.
Yeah, I have fun talking film with you guys.
It's a pleasure for me, too.
Yes.
And with you guys and you know, getting a chance to write about film and just the chance to spend time in the world of film is one of the greatest pleasures I have in my life.
And hearing from our lovely listeners and commenters, most of whom did not come to the concert just to boo us.
Yes, that's the first thing I thought of too, which was why they come to the concert just to boo us.
I didn't see. I thought this question was asked in a good spirit.
Thank you for listening, Peter.
Thank you. So this next email is a little longer. This is from Sam in Vancouver, Genevieve. Want to read it for us?
Sure. Sam writes, I wanted to chime in on a little detail Genevieve, that's me, mentioned that gave me a different read on Patterson than most. I don't put much stock in fan theories, but one of the things I love about Jarmusch, and Patterson in particular, is how open to interpretation his characters can be while still having a strong personality. We don't need to know Patterson's life story to find him fascinating enough to spend a week with. About halfway through the film, the repetition of twins got me wondering. What if that picture of Patterson in a Marine uniform we catch a glimpse of early in the film isn't actually Patterson at all? Is there anything to say that Patterson doesn't or didn't have a complimentary Marine Corps yin to his mellow bus-driving yang? A Patter twin, if you will. Well done. Well done. Would such a detail explain why, say, Patterson seems so unnerved by twins, or why I detected more discomfort than humility in Patterson being labeled a hero for disarming Everett at the bar and removing passengers from a bus that could have become a giant fireball? Having only seen the movie once, it's entirely possible I missed a piece of dialogue or some other small detail that soundly disproves this interpretation. Ultimately, it doesn't really matter to me. Like William Carlos Williams' Red Wheelbarrow, on which so much depends, the specific significance of an object like Patterson's picture isn't as thought-provoking as knowing it has a meaning to the one who appreciates it. P.S. Marvin is a good boy.
Wow. There's a lot of counterintuitive thinking in here, starting with Marvin is a good boy. Well, all dogs are good boys and girls.
What's interesting to me is that Marvin, if you look carefully, you'll find that his original owner was Andy's mom from Toy Story.
I really like this as a fan theory goes, though. I think the idea of Patterson himself as a veteran makes for a richer kind of character sketch than him as the brother of a veteran. But I don't see anything in your reading that, you know, that I object to as impossible. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I can't quite get on board with it. And he says it right here about Patterson disarming Everett at the bar. That spoke, I think, to someone who does have experience with guns and with combat.
But he didn't recognize it as a fake gun.
Yeah, well, that too. I mean, I don't know. I mean, but it's interesting, that place where your mind can wander, and Jarmusch doesn't discourage that.
Yeah, I do like in this letter how Sam hones in on two Jarmusch characters being open to interpretation while still having a strong personality. Mm-hmm. I think that is a very good way of putting it, and I think our conversation on both of those movies kind of bears that out, given the amount of information we are given on those characters and how much we were able to talk about them with that limited amount of information. So I think, this theory is just kind of another extension of that. So I'm glad Sam pointed that out.
I appreciate the imagination that went into that.
Yep.
So this last one, Keith, is from a reader who finally caught up with Moonlight, which we paired last year with Wong Kar-wai's In the Mood for Love. In that episode, we briefly touched on the memory/dream sequence in which Chiron's mother yells something unintelligible but clearly upsetting at her son. This listener has an idea about those unheard words, which, fair warning, may be upsetting to some listeners to hear.
Michael Brown writes, I believe that when Naomi Harris is first seen yelling at Little, she does call him a, quote, goddamn faggot. Although you can't hear what she is screaming, that is what I lip read. The look on the boy's face is devastated and devastating. The next scene, the first thing he says is, what's a faggot? The second time we see the same scene via a grown black stream, she's a bit more subdued and we do hear what she is saying. It is not the same tirade as the first time. His dream isn't pleasant, but not as hateful as the first tirade. That makes sense to me. I think because we do get, now that I'm not quoting, I won't say it, but we do get the F word. He does bring up the F word without us having seen him hear it. And it would make sense if it happened then, although it could also make sense as a schoolyard taunt. But yeah, I'll buy that.
I also buy it. And I think that it is powerful to not hear her actually say it, but hear his reaction to it and distress over it in the very next scene. I think that is probably more powerful than if we had actually heard her screaming the words at him.
And I think we did not come to that conclusion during that episode, did we?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. Though I think I felt that was true. Is there audio record of me thinking this?
Sure.
And then
sure,
you
Scott.
All say, no, Scott, forget it. She doesn't say that at all.
That's exactly as it happened.
That's memory how I remember it.
Memory can be very fluid, as evidenced in the film Moonlight and the podcast around it.
So as always, we appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may feature your response on a future episode or post it on Facebook for discussion. And that's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In the second half, we'll bring in Wiener and talk about how the campaign of another flawed, charismatic Democratic candidate did not lead anyone to the promised land. Look for that later this week, or better yet, subscribe to The Next Picture Show on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Follow us at facebook.com/nextpictureshow and follow us on Twitter @nextpicturepod so you'll always know when a new episode drops. Until then, we'll be giggling like 10-year-olds over our clever wiener puns and double entendres.